From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Hi, Ann.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
Did you watch the Grammys?
I did. Did you watch them? I didn't watch all of it, I have to say.
I did. And I think they should rename it the Alicia Keys Show.
Yeah, she's awesome.
Someone said she should be hosting everything all
the
time.
I agree.
And I agree also. So the Oscars she should host. She should host basically every show other than the CAFE Insider.
Right. Well, she could be a guest.
That would be pretty cool.
We could make the a section of the podcast about, you know, you're old when, because I will say watching the Grammys, I had a couple moments where I was like,
who's that?
Completely.
Well, I had my kids around and they schooled me on something.
My kid is not old enough yet, but I need either older kids or
you didn't know
listen
about
to more radio.
You didn't know about her?
I did not. There were a few. I was like, Shazam, help me out.
All right. We're now embarrassing ourselves. So let's get to some things that we know about.
Yes.
We have, this is a week where we have a lot to talk about. I guess we should start with Jeff Bezos.
Yes.
AMI. I guess to recap, Jeff Bezos suddenly posted something on the website Medium, where he took the bull by the horns, so to speak, and revealed, in his words, that he was the victim of an extortion attempt from AMI. That's the company headed by David Pecker.
The National Enquirer,
that had already published intimate texts between him and someone with whom he was having an affair. And now that looked like they were, according to Jeff Bezos and according to some of the texts and the back and forth emails that were published, threatening him with publishing more pictures, including pictures of his...
What is AMI referring to? Nether parts?
Nether parts.
I never thought we'd be talking about this publicly.
Genitalia.
Yes.
I think that's what they're called. If he didn't put out a statement saying, among other things, that Jeff Bezos' investigation of how the text came into the possession of AMI, he would have to say that there was no political motivation behind them.
Right.
So that was something very important.
He and the investigator he was using had been out saying that they thought that the original release of those text messages in a January Enquirer publication, that was politically motivated.
Right. And as we know, David Pecker is close to the President of the United States.
And Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, which is an important newspaper in America that has been critical of the president.
Right, and the president has attacked Jeff Bezos. So there's a lot of, you know, back and forth and attacks this way and that way. So it's not crazy to worry and wonder whether or not there's some political motivation. But so that was the state of play last week. So one question that is on the table, I guess, we can talk about, given our legal backgrounds, is was that extortion? I mean, Jeff Bezos says flatly it was extortion and blackmail. And the question is, was it extortion?
Before we even get there, just to step back for one second, it is a crazy thing that Jeff Bezos is sending around photos of himself. I just want to pause for a second because I feel like I've done a huge amount on internet safety, and I spent a lot of time when I was AG, and even still, telling young people, don't take a picture of anything that you don't want to see on the front page of the paper.
Just don't do it.
Like, just when in doubt. And, you know, I've seen cases of sextortion, revenge porn. This is a very serious matter. And we tell kids don't do it. We tell young people don't do it. And then you have the richest guy in the world, runs one of the top companies in the United States of America, taking and sending pictures back and forth. So I just want to start by saying,
it's a public service announcement. So
a momentary PSA. It's a pro tip. Please don't do this.
Don't do it.
Don't do it.
Don't do that.
Don't take those pictures and send them around. Now onto the crime.
Okay. So what's your view? And then we'll look at the defenses and talk about what AMI's lawyers are saying and David Pecker's lawyers are saying. Open and shut extortion case?
I don't think open and shut. I think we should talk about this a little. It's a little bit of a strange construction. So if you and I were thinking about extortion, the typical extortion would be, I'm going to publish these nude pictures of you unless you give me $1 million, right? Jeff Bezos, or $1 billion.
But that would clearly be extortion.
Yes,
right?
That's the typical case.
The more typical case is outside of this context is, you know, the mob guy goes to the restaurant owner and says, we're going to break your windows unless every week you give us $1,000, right?
Yep.
So that's more typical in the sense that there's a threat of violence.
Yes.
And physical destruction of property in exchange for a thing of value. And there's no debate about $1,000 being something of value.
Right. And so here the question is, conversations about reputation, reputational harm, can that be a thing of value is one of the questions. I would argue very strongly, yes, that the law allows for, it doesn't even have to be, you know, you just talked about property. It could be something that's tangible or intangible property. And there are plenty of instances in the law where we talk about people's reputations.
Yeah, should I look at this? Should we just read the statute quickly? Since people may be wondering, there's a statute on extortions in the federal code, 18 U.S.C. 875, which makes it very clear that whoever with intent to extort from any person, et cetera, any money or thing of value, which we'll talk about more, transmits in interstate or foreign commerce, any communication, et cetera, any threat to injure the property or reputation of the addressee shall be fined in this title and imprisoned, et cetera. So on the one hand, threat to reputation counts under federal law. You know, one defense on this issue of reputation that I heard Elkin Abramowitz, who represents David Pecker on television over the weekend, and Elkin Abramowitz, I know, friendly with him. He's an alum of the Southern District of New York, a very good lawyer, a very accomplished lawyer, and a very successful
white-collar criminal defense Let's be clear. He's not a, you know, he's not a bankruptcy lawyer or a real estate lawyer. He's a white-collar criminal defense lawyer.
Correct. And he, one of his arguments was, well, the story was already out. It was already known that Jeff Bezos had engaged in an extramarital affair. And intimate texts had already been published.
But there's a real difference with photographs and releasing partially naked photos of someone that you've...
Yeah, you don't have a buy. It's different. You know, going forward, right? This was going to be another tranche of stuff. And in fact, you know, almost definitionally, it was going to have a more serious effect because otherwise... You would think that the National Enquirer wouldn't be threatening
completely.
With it.
Yeah.
But the whole point is, if you don't do X, we're going to do Y, and Y is going to be really harmful to you.
Right.
So it doesn't really fly.
Not only really harmful to Jeff Bezos, but also probably really profitable for the National Enquirer. So, like, if we think about this, like, if they'd published those pictures, they would have obviously, you know, would have been incredibly embarrassing and harmful to Jeff Bezos's reputation, but also. They were basically giving up a financial opportunity because they would have put it front page of, you know, even if they didn't show the full pictures, people would have bought the paper probably to see that. And so their motivation is something I'm incredibly curious about because they are desperate, you know, to they're basically making a deal. We've got all these photos we're not going to put out in exchange for you to say that our initial story wasn't politically motivated, which basically says to me that it was.
Right.
Right.
And that goes to the other side of the equation. So on the one hand, the question is, was it a threat to reputation? It seems like it was. And on the other hand, what is the thing that they were trying to get? What is the thing? You know, so they weren't saying, give me $1,000, give me $1 million. They were asking for a statement to be put out. And so was that a thing of value? And it seems to me that based on what you just said a second ago, along with some other circumstances, the fact that they were willing to forego whatever profit they would have made by selling papers if they published these photographs and other emails in exchange for a statement means that they had calculated themselves that the statement itself was incredibly valuable.
I agree.
And you know,
I agree.
The fact that they were fighting so hard to prevent you know, this insinuation of a political motivation on their own part, I think speaks for itself.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting also is as you're talking about this sort of two sides of this, on the one side, it's the threat to release the pictures, which the outcome, which have value. Someone would pay for those probably, right? Pay for access to those either by buying the National Enquirer or something else, but also have a reputational harm to Bezos himself. So there's reputation associated with that. But then there's reputation on the other side. It's kind of a fascinating case, which is all about AMI saying, look, you're out there saying this stuff about us. We want you to say it's not true when, you know, as Bezos writes in his Medium post, I would have had to have falsely said that I didn't believe that it was politically motivated. And it's pretty clear from Bezos's, the way he writes it and the references and the lead investigators publicly said they think that the original actions were politically motivated.
I mean, Elkin Abramowitz says on behalf of David Pecker, you know, he doesn't represent AMI, I believe. I think he represents only David Pecker. Says, no, it's not a thing of value because all they were seeking was the truth. But putting aside what the truth is or is not, you know, and I think at this point we don't fully know, but we can discuss it in a second. They were asking for a specific statement of exoneration on a particular point to be made.
What had been said publicly, right?
The investigation would have shown, right?
Right. One of the things that went through my head when I first heard this was AMI, David Pecker, they are under a non-prosecution agreement as part of the Michael Cohen case. And, you know, one of the things we should just step back and talk about AMI as a political organization. They did cooperate and they provided information, but remember that they were the conduit for one of the payments to one of Trump's, one of the women who had said, I had an affair with Donald Trump. And so the money, in order to silence the woman, in at least one instance, went through AMI. So they did act politically on at least one occasion where they were supporting a presidential candidate.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a terrific point, and also shows that, unlike other companies, they're in a particularly sensitive, critical posture. And that is, on September 20th, 2018, AMI, through counsel, signed, as you said, a non-prosecution agreement with the Southern District of New York.
Yeah.
And you know, it's publicly available now. And
so
I have
they
a copy
get a benefit, right? They get a huge, like, can you talk us through?
Yes. So a non-prosecution agreement is a gift to an individual or to a corporation. And there are various reasons you might enter into one. And it's when there is the possibility of prosecuting someone, in this case, campaign finance violation, and the U.S. Attorney's Office decides, for one reason or a multitude of reasons, to give them a little bit of a pass. And that could be because the crime wasn't so significant enough for them to, you know, extract blood. It could be that the cooperation is more important. They get to keep the company in a tight leash, just to give you a sense of how, under the barrel. Is it under the barrel? Over the barrel? Where in connection with the barrel?
Not in the barrel.
Not in the barrel.
Over the barrel.
Right? Over the barrel? I think, okay, so they're over the... I'm an immigrant. I'm still learning. Among other things, a non-prosecution agreement says that AMI is not permitted to commit any other crime.
For three years.
And if at any point during that period they commit some crime, and it doesn't have to be a federal crime. It could be any kind of crime. It could be a tax crime. It could be obstruction. It could be...
Extortion.
Mm-hmm. And it could be a violation of state law or federal law. They can rip up this agreement and go ahead and prosecute them for the crimes for which they forbore before. And by the way, the statute of limitations during the period of this agreement is told, meaning it's stopped, so that they can bring those charges later. On top of that, AMI has a requirement that it shall cooperate fully with this office and any other law enforcement agency designated by this office. In addition, AMI shall provide to this office upon request any document, record, or other tangible evidence relating to matters about which this office or any designated law enforcement agency inquires of it. So now, just think how incredibly stupid it is.
Yep.
Even if it's the case that there's an argument that it's not slam dunk, open and shut extortion, when you're thinking about engaging in this back and forth,
yep,
with the richest man in the world, who obviously has, you know, resources and access to counsel himself.
And investigators.
And you know that you're under the yoke of a non-prosecution agreement, I think you want to avoid the risk of it looking like extortion. So I don't know.
And they played a hand where they just assumed, probably because they do this frequently and get away with it and intimidate people, they played a hand where they just didn't think that Bezos was going to do what he did, which is to basically say, look, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to release to the world, I'm going to get ahead of it and tell everybody what's out there and tell them that I think you're trying to extort me. And so they played a pretty risky game, AMI in my view.
Generally speaking, because they're getting into a fight with the richest man in the world, and there's the example of Gawker that people have been talking about, yeah, in connection with the suit
Peter
that
Thiel.
Hulk Hogan made, and you know Gawker no longer exists. And some people have been predicting, I'm not making this prediction, in the last week, that AMI is a walking dead company. But the other audience, intentional or not, for Jeff Bezos's post on Medium was the Southern District of New York,
right?
And there are reports, and look, if I were the U.S. attorney right now, I'd be having people in my office saying, you know, what do you think about the law here? What do you think about the facts here? Do you think it was extortion or not? And then they have to make a decision about whether they rip up the agreement. Now, there are some times when you have a cooperating witness or a cooperating company, and they're valuable enough that you actually don't want to rip it up because they're still providing you information about other things. But at a minimum, here they have to be considering very carefully whether they cancel the agreement.
And there's three things happening. So first is whether they would cancel the non-prosecution agreement, which means that they could be prosecuted for their conduct in the catch and kill work with Michael Cohen and Trump that Michael Cohen has already pleaded guilty to. The second is whether or not the federal crime of extortion was committed, which I think is pretty plausible. And I would make an argument that, you know, you could make a case for this. Again, you know, there needs to be more investigation, but on its face, I would be comfortable saying, I think this would be something I would, you know, probably say, let's go to the grand jury on. Again, there's a lot more information you need to get, but on its face, I'm comfortable saying, you know, yes, there are things of value and that there's an attempt to basically strong arm someone. The last piece is that there's also a possible state law claim of extortion here that could be brought. Now, I don't know if there'll be a state investigation, but for that non-prosecution agreement, it does go away if there's either a state or federal prosecution.
And they're required to cooperate with state authorities also. Here's the other thing about what you just said, which is so important, that unlike in the normal scenario where you're investigating something being extortion or not, so, you know, some rich person puts out a post and says, I've been extorted. The Southern District of New York, like any other prosecutor's office, would have to, you know, send agents, ask for voluntary cooperation, issue subpoenas, do all sorts of things, and they could be resisted and they could be fought in court. These guys are already under an obligation
to cooperate.
To provide every email, every text, every draft. They have no excuse not to provide anything that the U.S. Attorney's Office wants. So this investigation into whether or not it's extortion can happen more rapidly and can happen more thoroughly because, as I said, they're already under the yoke of this non-prosecution agreement. And then a fourth thing, beyond the three you already mentioned, is now you've awakened investigators to this idea of, are there other extortions?
Right, I agree. Are there other crimes? Bezos mentions that and says a lot of people told us they had to pay because they didn't have a choice. They had to sort of make a deal with AMI because they didn't have a choice.
Yeah, and for now, the scope of the agreement is that AMI was not supposed to commit any crimes subsequent to the signing of the agreement, which here is September 20th, 2018. And also, and obviously everything that happened with Jeff Bezos is in the recent time period. So as an initial matter, I would not be shocked if the prosecutors in SDNY said, not only do we want all the documents relating to this alleged extortion.
We want everything.
We want everything relating to any possible extortion or any possible blackmail since this date. And then maybe you start going before that too. And so
any instance where they have text messages or photos that they did not publish.
It's one of the most self-destructive business decisions, it seems, was made. And then you have to ask the question.
Why?
If you assume people, at least, you know, Jeff Bezos was acting in a way, presumably, you know, for personal reasons, and that happens. But this was a business that cared so much about getting a declaration that political motivations were not at play in publishing these photos and emails, that this was what they were prepared to risk. It makes you wonder.
I mean, there are a couple of other things. First of all, they made 5 months under the non-prosecution agreement. They didn't even make 6 months. I mean, that, like, if you're sitting in the U.S. Attorney's Office, you have to be sitting there basically being like, these people, like, what are you possibly thinking?
And it's blatant and it's brazen,
It's
stupid. And when people do it, when people do that, you then start to think to yourself.
They do it all the time.
They do it all the time.
Exactly.
And what else are they doing?
Yep.
And the question of whether or not AMI has committed a crime, the agreement as we understood it was not that, you know, you could only rip it up after you're prosecuted for a crime and convicted of a crime. It's in the estimation of the U.S. Attorney's Office. And obviously, it has to be a good faith estimation. So if there was flimsy evidence, I suppose AMI could go to court and say, we didn't commit the crime. And you would have some sort of mini hearing on the issue of whether or not the contract had to be enforced. But, you know, if the U.S. Attorney's Office decides, essentially in its discretion and in good faith, that there is enough evidence of a crime, separate apart from whether or not they charge that crime, the agreement can be ripped up.
And let's just talk for a second about how an investigation into the extortion here would go, which is that, you know, I think you would open up a grand jury investigation. You'd bring in, you obviously have access to a lot of emails, probably you could get access to the full investigation that was done by Jeff Bezos as an investigator. You would immediately subpoena and ask for that information. You'd also subpoena AMI, or, I mean, hopefully they'd cooperate, but you'd get all the emails and all the back and forth, as you said, not just on this, but on other matters. And so, you know, on its face, it appears to be criminal. But what you would do is go further to make sure that, you know, Bezos has he's given one version, his version of events. It seems to me very credible based on what we've seen. But as an investigation, you would want to go out and get everything you possibly could, find out who they talked to, start interviewing witnesses, bring people into the grand jury, and just be really thorough about that. So I always hesitate before I say, yes, I would charge a crime because I want to know sort of the 360 of something that's happened.
Yeah, absolutely. The odd thing about this is that I think as of yesterday, Sunday, we're recording this on Monday morning, Jeff Bezos has indicated that his investigation has concluded that he was not hacked. It doesn't look like the emails and the photographs were obtained by hacking by a government agency, which was suggested in the Medium post.
Yep.
But that it came to the attention of AMI and the National Enquirer because the person with whom Jeff Bezos was having the affair has a brother named Michael Sanchez. And I guess they have concluded in reporting that you and I have both seen that it was the brother who had access to this. Now, is he guilty of a crime?
Right. So Yeah. So there has been public reporting that it's a brother. And let's just stop on him for one second, because he is also something of a fascinating character. And, you know,
there's no dull characters here.
I know. Some of it you just can't make up. So, you know, a close associate of Roger Stone, in communication with Roger Stone, within days of Roger Stone being arrested on charges being brought by Mueller's team for charges of lying to Congress and trying to prevent a witness from testifying. He's also associated with Carter Page, who's another character in the sort of, I don't know, Trump campaign scandals about coordination with the Russian government. And he's a big pro-Trump supporter. And so I think that's where some of the questions about political motivation have also come in. I have a lot of questions about how he got access. If it's him, as has been publicly reported, let's just add one small caveat that he has not acknowledged that it's him. Like there's still some pieces out there. But if it's him, I have questions about how he got access to his sister's phone. But yeah, probably it's a crime. And you know, we need to know more information. But photos belong to a private person. If, for example, if she'd given him her password and said, "You can always be on my phone. You can take any pictures off," that's not going to be criminal. There's going to have to.
Or if she forwarded some of them.
Exactly. If she forwarded
them
to her brother.
Hey, guess what?
Exactly.
Here's Jeff Bezos.
Completely. Then it's not a crime. If she did not have knowledge that he was taking them off her phone, that's where I think an investigation into him is really warranted. Again, it kind of depends on their relationship and how this came to pass. But it is, you know, can you even imagine? It's her brother, right? I mean, it's one of those moments. It's, I don't know what the name of, like, one of those Greek plays is, where, like, you almost can't make up that.
Tragedy.
Yeah, it's like a...
It's one of the tragedies.
Yeah, but the
relevance, in part, of whether or not Michael Sanchez is subject to criminal prosecution is, as we've been talking about for many, many months now, and everyone's getting schooled on this, it makes him amenable to flipping.
Right.
So if he has, you know, the hammer on him, maybe he has information about other people. You said he's close to Roger Stone.
Oh, I forgot to say one other thing. He's also close to the chief content officer at AMI, Dylan Howard, who sent the first email. He's the guy that sent the first email to Bezos, where he sort of characterizes all the pictures that they have. And, you know, my favorite part is the last line saying, "No editor would want to have to send an email like this," right? Basically extorting you, right? "It gives me no pleasure to put you over the barrel." But anyway, they also have a personal relationship, a longstanding personal relationship.
It's also crazy that it was in an email.
It's crazy.
You know,
and one of them was sent by the deputy general counsel of AMI. And so, you know, they're going to say, look, this was, well, Elkan Abramowitz already said it. This was a legal negotiation. And so they're going to try to use the lawyers as a way to say, well, this wasn't extortion. This was a legal negotiation. Now, you can't use a lawyer to commit extortion, right? I mean, it's sort of, you can't do through a backdoor.
I mean, in other words, you can, but that doesn't immunize it.
Exactly. Oh, you can do it, but it doesn't, exactly. It doesn't make it.
It doesn't cleanse it of the extortionate intent.
It can still be a crime, right? Yeah. That's, I mean, a better way to say it.
It's sort of a clever way of disguising something. If the mob sends a lawyer to the restaurant and says, "If you don't give my guy $1,000 a week,
I'm going
to
burn down your restaurant.
I'm going to burn down your restaurant. Be ashamed something happened to your restaurant."
Still a crime.
Still a crime.
Still a crime. Lawyer or no lawyer.
I saw Alan Dershowitz over the weekend also talking about the First Amendment. And, you know, the First Amendment is very important.
Especially, it comes first, yes, it is.
But it is it is not, you know, it's like saying, and not to oversimplify it and to mock it too much, but in the same way that you show up at someone's door and you say, "If you don't give me $1,000, I'm going to burn your house down," that speech
also
is not protected.
Crime. Exactly.
A
crime.
You know, clear extortion versus murkier extortion is not protected by the First Amendment, no matter what people say.
AMI could have gone out and said, "Jeff Bezos is an idiot, he's a jerk, he treats people terribly," all fine. It's different when your language actually crosses the line. And the case law is pretty clear on this. And so I'm sure Alan Dershowitz would say, I mean, he sort of said everything is covered by the First Amendment, but that's just not the case. I mean, words can, in fact, be criminal. And so, you know, I think it's worth always keeping in mind, particularly freedom of the press and First Amendment issues, but I don't see it here.
All right. So lots of other things happened last week. By the way, do you realize that the State of the Union was only 6 days ago?
I know.
Right. So we don't talk about that because it's long forgotten. It seems like it was 45 years ago. But what happened last Friday all day was the acting Attorney General of the United States of America, Matthew Whitaker, testified in front of the House. How'd that go?
I didn't think it went so well. What'd you think?
It didn't go well for the witness at all. You know, and also in some ways it doesn't go well for the House, not to rag on the House since I worked in the Senate. But it's very, very hard, even if you don't have an obstreperous witness, to get anything done in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So you have 5 minute rounds with dozens of people.
Why do they do that?
Because there's so many members and everyone wants to take a shot and asking their questions.
It's really inefficient and an ineffective way to, in 5 minutes, it's really hard to build the kind of momentum to get real answers to questions.
Look, in other contexts, they sometimes have, you know, staffers do the interviewing.
Yeah.
Depending on whether it's investigation or oversight. It's a little bit more difficult, I guess, to delegate that when it's oversight, which is what this was.
Yeah.
But there was that moment, the famous moment, that if you saw nothing at all about the hearing, you probably saw a clip or heard a clip when Jerry Nadler was speechifying a little bit, and then he asked a question, and it went to Matt Whitaker, and he said, and I don't know if he was trying to make a joke or not, but he said, I see, Congressman, that your time is up.
Yep.
and that had a very bad reaction.
That's never a great idea to say to a member of Congress who is engaged in oversight of your department.
Chair, who has the gavel and has subpoena power.
Sorry, you're out of time.
Separate from whether or not it's disrespectful, It's not smart.
It's not a smart move. Yeah, I had a couple of similar reactions. First, I think the 5 minute rule is a terrible thing, and they need to change it. And they need to figure out if they care about the substance, then they really need to do something different, because it's almost impossible to get enough information.
It's very easy to filibuster, and he would pause the witness, Matt Whitaker. He would sometimes repeat the question. Yeah. He drank a lot of water. He was very hydrated. but another thing that happens. And we don't have to be overly harsh about non-professional prosecutors asking questions, but sometimes a question is asked and you wish it would be asked more rigorously, or more rigorous follow-up. And so one of the things that it was important to find out from Matt Whitaker was this issue of whether the president had, according to news reports, lashed out at him about the Southern District investigation of Michael Cohen. So great, that was what the reporting was. The verb used in the reporting was, he lashed out. But that's not necessarily the way that you should phrase the question if you're a member of Congress to the witness under oath. And to say, did the president lash out at you?
Right, you're characterizing it.
You're characterizing it.
Versus saying, did you have any conversation about Michael Cohen?
First, you do that first. Mm-hmm. And so you can truthfully answer no, even if there was some kind of conversation, if you don't agree with the characterization that it was lashing out.
Yeah, this is 101 for prosecutors and defense lawyers. People will agree with facts. They generally will not agree with your conclusions. And so if you want to get people talking and you want to get information, the more conclusions you make, the less likely you are to get information. And so you have to start, did you have any conversations with the president about Michael Cohen pleading guilty or, the Southern District's investigation?
Which is why it doesn't take 5 minutes. So you start and you establish, as you said, the fact of a conversation, and then you try to winnow it down to see how you characterize it. One thing that we talked about when I was in the Senate, but it's hard to do because individual senators have and individual members have their own staffs and have their own agendas and priorities, is we tried on occasion, it never worked, to have sort of a chain system. So the one member asks certain questions about a meeting or about a policy, and when they are unable to finish,
The next one follows up.
But
I think that kind of coordination is very difficult. I think you said something else that's important too. And we see it on both the D and the R side, which is the speechifying. So the folks who are asking the questions are so busy trying to give their version of events that they're not actually asking the questions they need to ask to get the information. I also found when I worked on the Hill, and I wonder if you agree, there's not enough listening to ask the right second and third and fourth question. And so it is hard, but that's sort of what you learn being a lawyer in many ways, is the first question rarely gives you the answer. And so you got to keep going. And if they don't understand the substance enough, then you only get you get a lot of first questions without the follow-up.
Just a quick aside. I used to say long before he became the special counsel that one of the best witnesses on Capitol Hill that I've ever seen, and I saw him multiple times, was Bob Mueller. And the reason is he did the opposite of what a lot of witnesses do, which is to filibuster, to try to get through the 5 minutes, to pontificate so they don't have to get asked the second question. Bob Mueller understood that it's best to just be straightforward. And sometimes a question would be asked of him, have you ever done X, Y, or Z? And he would just say no. And I would watch members
who they didn't don't know
have,
what to
write. Yeah. And the staffs had written for them questions. So, when he refuses to answer, or when he obfuscates, go down this line of inquiry, and they couldn't because he just was upfront. He said, no, didn't do that.
So two other things just to sort of throw out there about Whitaker. One is that, he kept saying, I can't talk about the investigation, but he is the one that went to the mic and said, kind of unsolicited.
He did.
The I've been briefed and the investigation is going to be over soon, which is something you and I would never have said as someone overseeing an investigation, right? We would never have made that information public in the vast majority of instances. I can't think of any time I ever did that. So he was a talker when he wanted to be a talker and not a talker when he didn't want to be a talker. The other is, you know, and again, I kind of agree with your sentiment on this of how you ask questions, but they were pushing him on, you know, is the Mueller investigation a witch hunt? And I'm not sure that's the best line of questioning, but you have the president's nominee to be the full-time attorney general who just did exactly sort of what you described with Mueller, who just said, no, you know, yeah. I've known Bob Mueller. I don't think he's engaged in a witch hunt. You know, there may be things that I don't agree with, but, you know, and there's a huge difference. And so Whitaker to me looked incredibly political, and I did not, you know, he was refusing to answer in a way that I thought, first of all, I don't believe that neither the president nor a member of the president's senior team, they put Whitaker in there for a reason because they knew that he would be simpatico with their view of the Mueller investigation and whatnot, I think. And so it felt a little bit incredible to me when he just refused to say, you know, anything about any conversation with the president or anyone else.
He was just trying to get out of there.
Alive.
Alive.
Yeah.
And I think based on the skirmishes.
Hydrated. Yeah.
And well hydrated. Based on the skirmishes leading up to the testimony, you may remember that Jerry Nadler first, you know, had a vote on a subpoena, even though Whitaker agreed to testify voluntarily. Even the Justice Department fired back with a letter. Because I do think that Jerry Nadler overplayed his hand a little bit. I think his mind was in the right place, but he got a little over his skis.
Yeah.
Because it gave the Justice Department on Thursday afternoon the excuse to say this is unprecedented and, you know, making it clear that they could fight the right. subpoena. And unless there's going to be a commitment not to serve the subpoena because he's coming voluntarily, he's not going to show up. And at the end of the business day on Thursday, Nadler, realizing that the most important thing for him was to make sure the guy shows up.
Completely.
Because he's going to be out of the job in a few days, and then you could fight over the subpoena in court for months, and then nobody's going to care in a few months. That kind of skirmish, you're going to see a lot more of.
Right. I agree. And what Nadler was trying to do, and I agree with you, I don't think he did it the right way. He was trying to sort of send a message of strength to say, like, look, we expect you to come in and talk to us. Like, don't come in here and just say executive privilege. And I think he was trying to send that message. He was trying to sort of eliminate the back and forth. And part of it might be that Whitaker's time is so limited and he's going to be out. What I think is really interesting is that, look, we've seen this with every administration, Democrat and Republican. It's part of checks and balances that the Congress switches, and then the president has to answer a lot of questions, and the executive branch is subjected to a lot of oversight. The executive branch doesn't like it, and so they try to drag it out, not answer questions, avoid providing documents to the extent they can. The congressional committees then issue subpoenas. They consider holding people in contempt. It gets super complicated because, as a rule, DOJ decides who's in contempt and who isn't, and DOJ is obviously part of the executive branch. So I think we're going to have a lot of conversations about this over the next year or two, but it was definitely an attempt by Nadler to say, like, this is serious, like, don't play a game with us.
And I think the other thing he was doing was maybe teeing it up, because just having a witness voluntarily agree to come testify without a subpoena and then refusing to answer questions on certain subjects makes it more difficult to take it to court,
right.
Because he's not in sort of contempt of a particular subpoena, right? Because yes. his testimony was not compelled. So maybe he was trying to lay the groundwork for that and also show strength. But at the end of the day, he probably learned a lesson about how to deal with it. As you say, executive privilege is something we're going to be talking about a lot. You know, there's no clear definition of what it is, and there's no clear mechanism on a strict timetable to resolve those disputes. So the House is in the same position that we were in when we were in the Senate in 2006 when the control of the Senate switched back to the Democrats. And then I was the chief counsel of a subcommittee beginning in 2007, in January of 2007. And we, you know, proceeded with this investigation of the Justice Department. And there were claims
of firing of U.S. attorneys.
Firing of U.S. attorneys and the politicization of the Justice Department, which went on for many months. And what ends up happening ultimately is you negotiate and you reach an accommodation. So, you know, I helped to advise the committee on issuing subpoenas to various people. Those subpoenas were voted up in the committee, and we asked for documents and depositions to various people. I took a lot of depositions behind closed doors, and then the members had their own hearings after that. And then we would have trips to the White House. We would go and we would meet with, not necessarily in the White House, sometimes they came to the Senate, but with Fred Fielding, who was the White House counsel at the time, because we had an interest in getting something,
right.
And they had an interest in looking like they were being reasonable.
And not being obstructionist.
Yeah, so nobody,
that was also pretty public too, just to point that out, that the firings were public and then the investigation was public. And so they had an interest in not appearing like, and it was already being reported that there were issues with why people were fired. And so I think you had a lot of momentum.
So, you know, the members of Congress, they do have subpoena power, but it's not quite the same.
It's not the same as being a U.S. attorney.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Where we have men and women with guns who can go and yeah. and search
and
homes.
Judges and, who will put you in jail if you don't comply or fine you.
On a quick timetable. Yes. It's just, you know, and I think courts have appreciated that when they're trying to arbitrate between the interests of the executive branch, and those are, by the way, executive privilege is a legitimate thing. It's a
I
real
agree.
Thing. And Democratic presidents and Republican presidents have both asserted it incredibly strongly. It's a real thing. Oversight is also a real thing. And so, you know, unlike in situations where you have a prosecutor's office dealing with a company or a private individual over an extortion, you know, claim, the courts want to be a little careful about stepping into the politics.
Yeah. And remember, the president gets to decide. I'm going to call this executive privilege. And so there's a subjective judgment that gets made there about when they invoke it and when they don't. And everything the president does is not executive privilege, which is one of the complicating factors. But then people have to object to that and make, you know, make legal moves in order to get that information. And then a court gets to decide what should be privileged and what isn't. That can take a really long time.
Can I ask you a question, Anne? Is that why you think the president spends most of his time in executive time?
That's a very good question.
That causes,
yes.
Does he think automatically the privilege?
It's executive time is executive privilege.
Executive time is executive. So let's talk about two other things fairly quickly. Adam Schiff. Another chairman of an important House committee.
The
Intelligence Committee, also known as HPSI. So he basically announced that he has a broad investigation with multiple subparts that he's going to be conducting himself. So there's another example of a chairman asserting his rights under the gavel or with respect to the gavel.
Yes. And it was also reported that they're providing a lot of information to Mueller's team from witnesses who'd previously testified.
Well, the official transcripts. There's something I don't get about that. So they provided apparently 50 transcripts of witness testimony, all of which I believe the Mueller team has already had access to sort of informally or through the DNI process. But this allows them, if they want to bring a formal charge of lying to Congress, they need sort of the official certified copies.
That they're under oath.
But is it odd to you that they sent 50? Because you would think
50 is a lot.
You would think that they would determine, you know, these three or four we think are ones where you might.
Do you think they're worried that that might get leaked out and then those three or four people would be clearly identified?
Maybe.
I mean, if you send 50, then nobody knows.
And then in the cover letter, you're like, look at Don Jr.
Exactly.
Don Jr.
Yeah. Or you have you whisper as you hand over the 50.
Look at number seven.
But I do think sometimes, you know, I think it would have leaked out probably if they'd sent two. And so it would have created this sort of impression that those folks were likely to be charged, which may not be the case. And so that might be a piece of it. The one thing I'd say about Schiff's investigation is it looks very broad. I mean, the one sort of reaction I had is that there are sort of five separate parts of it, a lot of which does look similar to Mueller's work. And so, you know, there are things that look a little bit different and maybe sort of would go beyond. Obviously, Mueller's doing a criminal investigation, and I think Congress in an oversight role, you know, whether or not someone intentionally did something and violated a law is a slightly different question than whether or not, for example, the president or other folks around him were compromised in any way in relation to having conversations with foreign governments and negotiating with foreign governments.
Yeah.
But it does look broad to me. What's your reaction to it?
It looks very broad to me also. And I guess I have two observations. One is, you know, it may be that he's just trying, I don't know if they're going to look at all of this, but that he wants to set down the ambit as very broad.
Yeah.
So he can't later be accused of going sort of off the reservation. I mean, he stands in a very different position from Robert Mueller, but one of the criticisms of Mueller, which I don't think is well-founded, but it's, you know, made, is that the initial investigation was supposed to be X, you know,
right.
Collusion,
right.
Interference with the election in 2016.
So Schiff's doing the opposite. And
he's saying, look,
everything's mine.
Everything is mine.
Yeah.
The world is my oyster.
Yep.
And so, you know, depending on what he chooses to focus on, it will be okay, at least with respect to his own terms
it's
that he's setting
the
at the beginning
of
the session
of
Congress. And the reason for that, I think, is that he can't look at everything. What people forget is, you know, he's not the FBI. He doesn't have the FBI. He has good staffers. They're staffing up with really good lawyers and investigators, but it is a small group.
Yeah,
he doesn't have nearly the resources that the special counsel has, that a U.S. attorney's office has. And so, you know, when I look at this, and you may also, from the perspective of having run a prosecutor's office, and if people came to me and said, you know, I'm assigning two people to look at all of this, you're like, well, that's going to take you 45 years. You don't have, and again, right. as we said,
it's true.
They don't have, he doesn't have the same tools.
Yeah.
You know, he has some.
They're going to have to prioritize and focus.
He has some
in.
Subpoena power, but they don't have 100 people they can send to all over the world to interview witnesses in other countries.
Not to mention that sometimes.
And wiretaps and body warrants. They are limited in their investigative ability. And largely what congressional investigations are about is having things that are in the public record that they can ask questions about, ask for voluntary, even though they have subpoena power, but ask for voluntary compliance. And then doing things in a public forum such that there is oxygen lent to their investigation and the public wants to know what else is going on.
Yeah, whether you're answering questions.
Yeah, whether it's a good faith investigation or a bad faith. And whatever you think about the Benghazi investigation, you know, it had oxygen because there were a lot of people, for good or ill,
who
wanted to know, who had questions.
I agree with that. Both during the State of the Union and then in the president's tweets in response to the Schiff investigation, during the State of the Union, the president talked a lot about the investigations that are happening and really, I think, sort of painted them in a negative light. And I would take issue with that in a really strong way, which is that, look, the president of the United States gets oversight by Congress. And if there's allegations of criminality that warrant an investigation, that's the way the world works. And by the way, it's worked both ways for Democrats and Republicans over the years. But in response to the Schiff announcement of what it was, Trump kept talking about presidential harassment. Like he's sort of, and it's a term that McConnell used. And I just.
McConnell gave him a great term.
I can't get over it. It's sort of like, you know, it makes me cringe. It's sort of, is he saying it's sexual harassment is obviously a terrible thing. There are other forms of harassment. It really, it sort of immediately is trying to send this message that the underlying questions are not valid and that you're harassing, you're tormenting me with them in a way that's not fair.
I'll take a slightly controversial position. No president likes to be investigated. No secretary of state likes to be investigated. And it is somewhat natural to cast aspersions on the investigation, particularly when the people doing the investigation are, in fact, politicians. You know, there is an element of politics. I don't like the allegation when it's made against Bob Mueller or you know, independent-minded United States attorneys. These are members of Congress. And people said it about Devin Nunes. I think it was well placed there. We'll see how Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler and others conduct themselves. But it is not crazy, and I don't say this lightly, it is not crazy for a president to try to lay down the predicate.
And say there's political motivation.
Political motivations.
Yep.
You know, it's more acceptable and plausible when you're talking about actual politicians and people who may run for higher office one day.
Right, versus Mueller. I think that's
versus
fair
Mueller.
Point.
But the craziest thing, you mentioned the State of the Union, which we thought we'd forgotten about, but I guess we didn't fully forget about it, is when he said... And, you know, so presidential harassment is a good soundbite, and he can use it, and his base can use it, and they can use it in an argument, and it's like anything else. You know, if you don't like an article, you say fake news.
Yep.
If you don't like a subpoena, he's like presidential harassment, and it works for him. But I don't know who wrote this line, but President Trump said in the State of the Union, if there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
It's like Dr. Seuss presidential State of the Union for
build a wall, crime will fall. I didn't make that up. That was the thing that your president said. Now, with respect to part of this thing in the State of the Union, I agree with him. If there's going to be peace, there cannot be war.
Right.
Is that fair?
Fair.
That's fair. But the other part of this, if there's going to be legislation, there cannot be investigation.
Why not?
If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. Like, I don't think that that's true. People can do multiple things, and that was not well considered.
I also think that there's the one thing about presidential harassment, and I agree he's going to keep using it and it's out there. But when you read the sort of original comment that McConnell made, it sort of cut the other way. McConnell was saying, look, we did this to Bill Clinton and it kicked back against the Republicans. It didn't really work out that well for us. And so I think McConnell was sort of saying it, you know, presidential harassment, you're sort of basically people are investigating and going after the president, but it's not a great idea politically.
Look,
so,
it can be, it depends on how it goes. You know, there's this question about whether or not members of Congress are going to request and make public the president's tax returns because he's refused to disclose them because he has the longest audit in the history of the world. You got to be careful. You know, reasonable people, independents and others might think, well,
Do you think it's worth seeing the taxes now?
I think so. I mean, I think everyone assumes that Bob Mueller has them. You know, Adam Schiff had to be very careful in how he talked about the tax returns to say, you know, we're actually not interested in learning if he cheated on his taxes or if they show that he's worth less than he claims.
I think the only question is whether there's a way in which he could be subjected to foreign leverage,
right,
and influence. And I think that is an important question.
But I think, you know, with respect to all these chairs of these committees, they need to be careful in having been involved in these investigations. If you're showing some fruit and you're showing some real bad conduct, you know, in a relatively short period of time, then you're going to have momentum and people will say, okay, well, then you're not barking up the wrong tree. I hate the term witch hunt, but it is much easier, as I've said, to apply the term witch hunt and have it stick when you're talking about political people in Congress than when you're talking about independent appointees in the Justice Department.
Yeah. And to your point, I think that's a great analysis that if you can show that there is value in the investigations you're doing, I think you get a longer leash to continue those investigations in Congress. If you spend 6 months just asking for everything and there's no indication that you're actually going in the right direction or there are problems, then at some point I think people start to question the validity.
And you can't overstate. And if you're going down an avenue of inquiry and it's not yielding fruit, you must abandon it and move on to something else. And I think it's very important. And look, I think Adam Schiff has done a pretty good job of sort of, you know, he speaks very unemotionally. He doesn't even crack jokes often that I can see. He's sober minded about
Maybe
it.
Maybe he's just not a funny guy.
You know,
I don't know.
I don't know him well enough to know. Maybe he does open mic night every once in a while, and we're not aware of it.
But no, he's been serious about the work that they're doing.
You just can't overstate.
Straightforward.
I mean, you know, the more that I think, you know, I'm showing my bias here in favor of career prosecutors. The more that the committee folks can act like, you know, prosecutors in the sense that they're not speechifying, they're trying to get to the facts, they're being fair about the interpretation of facts. When something doesn't lead somewhere, they can see that
and
it's not leading somewhere, and you move on.
Yep.
And the more credibility the investigation will have. It's a tough balance if you're elected and you oppose the president, right? And also investigating things that are close to the president. It's a difficult thing to show that you're being fair. But it can be done, and the best way it can be done is if you can find ways to get, you know, bipartisan support. I don't see that happening here. The investigation we did in 2007 was bipartisan. It was when Arlen Specter was a Republican. He was a Republican ranking member of the committee.
I forgot that, yeah.
And his staff, Arlen Specter, Republican Arlen Specter's staff, and Senator Schumer's staff, a very good staff, we worked together.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were some disputes.
I don't think that would happen today.
No. And so it makes it more difficult, you know, to explain.
What also makes everything look completely partisan.
You know, that's why I think you have to bend over backwards to show that you're being fair, to show that you're not departing too much from prior precedent, and that you're actually yielding, you know, results.
Yeah, I still think it's really important to have to have investigations where there's a basis for them, because again, I think oversight
basis
matters
is good. Yeah,
so
basis.
Much. Like, you know, that look, they shouldn't just investigate everything that they politically disagree with. But I do think that the American public voted for checks and balances, and part of that is congressional oversight.
Paul Manafort, also in the news. There was a proceeding in connection with Manafort's sentencing at which one of the top people rank-wise in the special counsel's office, Andrew Weissman, some of what he said in court was unsealed, including
that Andrew Weissman described an August 2nd, 2016 meeting in New York between Manafort, Gates, and Kalimnik, who of course has been reported to be associated with Russian intelligence, and someone who did work with Manafort, and the person to whom Manafort actually provided the polling data during the presidential campaign, that during this time, which is when Manafort was the campaign chair, what Weissman said about this meeting he described as being, quote, very much to the heart of the question of the special counsel's investigation. And Weissman went on to say, there is an in-person meeting with someone who the government has certainly proffered to this court in the past, is understood by the FBI, assessed to be have a relationship with Russian intelligence, referring to Kalimnik. And there is an in-person meeting at an unusual time for somebody who is the campaign chairman to be spending time and doing it in person. And I think, you know, the importance of that is that they're essentially saying, we're focused on that meeting. Manafort is the campaign chair for Trump at that moment in time. There's a Russian asset there. It's also been reported that Gates and Manafort left the meeting separately. They sort of went out a back door. What happened in that sort of release of that transcript is it just shows us one of the areas of focus that the special counsel is really focused on this.
Which is right at the heart of this discussion of collusion. And right at the height of the campaign, you know, it's after Donald Trump is the nominee. I think it says something. if such a person like Andrew Weissman says that in open court. And he said a second thing in open court.
About
pardons.
As
well, about pardons. And said, you know, sort of addressing, I guess, the elephant in the room, that maybe Paul Manafort was lying to, quote, augment his chances for a pardon, which shows also, you know, which is not unreasonable, but he's confirmed it, that the special counsel's office is thinking about the pardon
and
cares about the pardon.
Part of the motivation.
And is worried about the pardon.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
It also, it strikes me as interesting of the things that the special counsel's office understands what Manafort was truthful about and what he lied about. And so them saying that he may be lying about this because of his effort to get a pardon basically raises a lot of really interesting questions to me of,
yeah.
Okay, was he willing to give up himself but not the president? You know, it's sort
they
of...
They have the full picture.
Exactly.
So they know, as you're saying, you know, where he's exaggerating, where he's minimizing, and where he's trying to curry favor.
Really interesting.
All right, we've gone a really long time.
So we have,
now,
sorry.
Let's answer a question from...
A really important question.
A really important question is probably the most significant thing we'll be discussing ever. This comes from Papaya Pulp, at Papaya Pulp. Great name.
I love papayas.
Dear Preet, as an avid listener to your cast, I've noticed that you render the past tense of to plead as pled, whereas your esteemed colleague, Ann Milgram, uses pleaded. Is there anything else that you ever disagree about? Love the show best. Hashtag ask Preet from Tim. I say pled because pled is shorter. Pled is more elegant. It seems better.
Ooh, ouch.
Yeah. So
that hurt.
Defend your pleaded.
Okay. So I had a press guy who was a big grammar guy who said pleaded when somebody's pleaded guilty and that was the correct grammatical phrasing for it. If you read major newspapers, they tend to go pleaded, although I think that's changing a little bit.
So I'll tell you a secret.
I support you, Preet.
So, you know, this was an issue we went back and forth on with a copy editor in my book. I don't know if you know, I have a book coming out.
Can I admit publicly that I've read it and I loved it? I got an
yes.
advanced copy.
You should say that. You should say that
it's
everywhere.
Fantastic.
You should have a billboard
a tattoo
that says that. And I polled five former prosecutors from my office who are now, four former prosecutors who are now judges who are friends of mine.
Does the fact that they're judges matter?
No, well, I don't know.
They get more credibility than I do.
They have life tenure.
Yeah.
And I asked them, because in the office, lots and lots of people would say pled when you stood up in court, and I didn't, a lot of other people did. And I asked these judges, and all four said they used pleaded.
Yep.
But it's my book, and I overruled them. And so I can.
I thought that was going to go a different direction. I thought
I can
you were going to
say spoiler. Maybe I shouldn't be admitting this. This is a spoiler. Nobody in my book pleaded guilty.
People pled guilty.
They all pled guilty.
You know, it's funny. When
and
I was
I stand
in court,
by it.
I would say... Somebody pled guilty. It's the colloquial way you would say it. But then when I started doing press releases and became AG and was schooled on this by a very erudite press person, I became a pleaded person.
Look, I'm very,
I stand by it, Preet.
I'm very orthodox and traditionalist in lots and lots of other ways with respect to grammar. I use the Oxford comma, also known as the series comma. But on,
I'll tell you
on
one
pled,
other. Yeah.
Probably also because the people who were getting in my kitchen about pleaded were annoying.
One other thing we disagree with, I think. I mean, you know, I'm a coffee drinker and you're a Diet Coke guy.
Yeah, I'm not so much coffee.
Yeah. It's a small thing, but I mean, there are plenty of other things I'm sure we differ on, but that came immediately to mind of, you know, can you really trust someone who doesn't drink coffee? I'll leave you with that.
Okay. So with that, Anne, that's all the time we have today for Insider. We'll be back next Monday. So send us your questions to insider@cafe.com.
And we'll answer them. See you soon.
This is the Cafe Insider podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Ann Milgram. The producers at Pineapple Street Media are Kat Aaron, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and Max Linsky. The executive producer at Cafe is Tamara Sepper. And the Cafe team is Julia Doyle, Calvin Lord, Vinay Basti, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.